This has become a really fun commitment for me. We came early tonight and we did a little sightseeing around Winston-Salem. What a wonderful town you guys have. Well, I don't know where the heck we were, but we were driving by golf courses and incredible houses. Just really, really a beautiful town. And I'm having a great time here. You're all very hospitable too. We've been talking about some history. We've been talking about some background information, where the book Alcoholics Anonymous comes from, why it was written. But mainly, we've been focusing in on step one. I'm hoping to move us through step one tonight and get on to step two next week. But where we are tonight is on the top of page 25. I love the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love it because it has clear-cut directions for a recovery plan. It explains alcoholism really, really well, and it makes clear at least three times anything that we really need to do. You know, they tell us at least three times in this book how important it is. One of the aspects of the alcoholic illness or addictive illness itself is an almost utter inability to have an accurate self-appraisal, to form an accurate self-appraisal. Like, okay, here's how much trouble I'm in. You know, that's usually not what happens. What we do is we minimize, and we think, you know, we got this, okay? Yeah, I know that I've been in the hospital 12 times, and I've wrecked 35 cars, and I'm on my fifth family, but you know, I got this. I don't really need a lot of your help. I can figure this out. Well, you can't figure it out, and you do need a lot of help. And the book explains 15 different ways how much help you need and how much trouble you're really in. Now, it's become fashionable in a lot of groups around the country to not pay much attention to this. You know, that's the stuff the old low bottoms, you know, had to deal with. That's the way the program was back when. You know, today we've got a fellowship sharing type of a program, and you know, and that's okay, unless you're in real trouble with alcoholism. Yeah. Let me tell you, alcoholism was the same in 1939 that it is now. And spiritual recovery processes are the same now that they were in 1939. We don't need a new book. We don't need, you know, somebody to rewrite this thing. We really don't, because this worked so well. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous itself, one of the smartest things they ever decided was to not mess with the first 164 pages in this book. For the first 164 pages to be changed, it would take 75% group approval, you know, throughout the world or some crazy thing like that, and you'll never get 75% of anybody showing up anywhere. You know, so it's a given that this is not going to be changed, hopefully. You know, you never know with New York, but hopefully. Anyway, I'm going to start. It says, there is a solution. It's been talking about graphic detail. It's been talking about how alcoholism shows up, how it presents, okay? It's been showing in graphic detail, and it's going to continue to do that. But right here, it talks about a solution. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. So the self-searching, that really is kind of step four. The leveling of pride and confession of shortcomings really is step five. Step four and step five are required for recovery, okay? There are no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous, and to sit in a chair in AA, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. But if you want to recover, the fourth and the fifth step are required. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. When we see wholesale recovery, when we see multiple recoveries, when we see people who were just like us, and we see them recover, it has to get our attention. That's what got Bill's attention when Ebby came over and did that 12-step call on him. Bill saw the lights were on in Ebby's eyes. He hadn't seen the lights on in Ebby's eyes ever. So something is going on. There's a big-time shift in this individual. And when we come into AA, or we come into any of the 12-step fellowships, hopefully we see that in somebody. We see the recoveries. And, you know, it's hard to say it doesn't work, or I shouldn't bother with this, when you see so many recoveries. We found much of heaven, and we've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. You want to stall out a discussion meeting sometime when they ask for a topic? Say, would everyone in here please share about their experience with the fourth dimension? And you'll quickly see the meeting that the topic will change to fear or something, you know? The reason for that, because not everybody gets to the fourth dimension. Not everybody does this work. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. What does a spiritual awakening look like? You know, let's jump to the end of the steps. A spiritual awakening is the solution or the answer or the treatment for alcoholism. What does it look like? How does it manifest? It manifests in your whole attitude toward life, toward your fellows, and towards God's universe changing. It's a shift in perception. It's a deep, deep shift in perception. You no longer see out of the same pair of glasses. And that's part of what a spiritual awakening is. It happens to many of us in many different ways. But the things that are common to spiritual awakenings are those. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. This 12-step program is about accessing the direct power of God. That's what this 12-step program is about. This is not a self-help program. When you go into a bookstore and you see the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the self-help section, they got it in the wrong section. Because this is not self-help. This is God help. This is accessing the direct power of God, because that's what these early members recognized and called that extra power that they got from doing this work was added to them so they could recover, so they could remain abstinent, so they could, their problems would become solved. They'd be able to go back to work. You know, they grew healthy. There's a million promises in this book. If you want to do an exercise sometime, go through this book and highlight every single statement of hope or every single promise. You'll find somewhere between 150 and 250 promises in this book. And they always materialize if we work for them. Now, the biggest promise I see is that we, if we do this work, what we do is we move enough of our self-will and our self-centeredness aside that God's power can come into our lives and heal us. You know, the healing power comes from God. Think about this. A physician doesn't really heal. What a physician does is creates an environment where healing can take place. They'll set a bone, or they'll create an antiseptic type of environment, and then they got to stand back and they have to allow healing to happen. You know, that's kind of what we're looking at in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have to create the spiritual environment for God to be able to do God's job. And that's what the steps, and that's what the meetings, and that's what the service ethic and all that is about. Creating that spiritual environment where the power of God can come in. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I was real doubtful that there was an interventionary deity out there that was going to be helping me. I had gone through more problems and I had shot myself in the foot more times and I had looked stupid more times than you can imagine with my drinking. And I thought, if there is a God up there who's pulling strings, he's like a cosmic Alan Funt. You know what I mean? Because what he's doing is he's going, hey, let's watch Chris crash into the wall outside the police station on Quaaludes and ask the cops for directions, you know? St. Peter, won't that be a riot? You know, I mean, you know, because if there is a God, you know, he was really not helping me. But the fact of the matter is I see things in a much clearer way now. I wasn't helping. You know, God in his infinite love has given us free will, and we have an inalienable right to screw our lives up if we so choose. We do, you know. So what we need to do is, you know, sometimes we need to turn our self-will in at the door and become willing to follow spiritual principles. And when we do that, you know, we really can recover. And that's what these early AAs discovered. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. The other was to accept spiritual help. Okay? Door number A. Try to blot out the consciousness of your intolerable situation while you go all the way down the scale to an alcoholic death. Door number B. Accept spiritual help. Let's talk a little bit about that intolerable situation. You know? What does that look like? Yeah. Because this is not an easy decision to make. Not for alcoholics. Spiritual help. Oh my God. You know, is there a door number C? You know? Can I go to a therapist? Primal scream therapy, you know? There's got to be something. No, there's not. There's dying alcoholic death. Accept spiritual help. When you get that clear on what you're on your problem, there's a lot less resistance moving through the rest of this work. What kills alcoholics is the resistance to this work. I do a lot of stuff online, and I'm part of a lot of addiction groups on LinkedIn and stuff. And this one guy was pretty much slamming AA and 12-step fellowships the other day, and he was citing statistics. And this is the statistic that he cited. He goes, people that go into AA as a whole, the recoveries are in the single digits. Somewhere around 6% of the people who are exposed to AA get sober and stay sober permanently. And he goes, that's about the same amount of people who, if you gave them a placebo, would stay sober for the rest of their life. And that was a statement this guy made. Now, he's got a lot of money to make, you know, off of alcoholics out there doing clinical and psychiatric and all that type of stuff, okay? So it's not in his best interest for people to run off to AA and actually get sober and recover. But if you're looking at people who walk through that door, he's probably right. Probably somewhere around 6% of the people will end up plugging in enough that they'll be able to stay sober for good and for all. But the fact of the matter is somebody who walks through the door and sits in some meetings, that's not the recovery process. The recovery process is outlined in this book. The recovery process is not attending a bunch of meetings. And that's what those statistics are based on. Because they stand outside the door with a clipboard and they ask you, you know, how long you've been sober, blah, blah, blah. And they do their thing, and they think they're assessing the success of Alcoholics Anonymous that way. And all they're doing is they're questioning meeting attenders. And you know as well as I do that a lot of people blow through here. See this whole thing as an overreaction to a problem that they've really got under control. You know? Or else they get it, they have an issue with it. You know, everybody in there just complains, you know? I can't, you know. Or they come in and they just don't understand why it would help them. There's a lot of people that blow through here. Rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly follows the recovery process. And that is still true. Every once in a while, someone shows the absence of intelligence enough to ask me to sponsor them. Okay, and you know what that means is you're coming over to my house and you're going through the steps. You know, well, should I call you every night? No. You know, do I have to go to 90 and 90? No. What you have to do is you have to come over to my house and you have to go through the steps. And the people that make it, every single one of them who got through step 9 that I've ever worked with is still in Alcoholics Anonymous or another 12-step fellowship, and they're working with other people, they're still sober, and their lives are incredibly, you know, over the top. Their quality of life is over the top. Every single one. Now, I've seen a million people come in and hang out in the meetings, you know, and share. Okay? Well, here's what happened to me today. Thank you for letting me share. You know, okay. I'm going to go over to page 28. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by faith, by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. That really is an important statement. I know many, many people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are religious, as well as Alcoholics Anonymous members, and they do great. And then I know a lot of people who are non-religious, however, they're very, very spiritual. They're about the business of helping God's world out. You know, they're really out there on the firing lines. And they do great. You know, these are just people who have learned the spiritual principles. That's what will bring about recovery. You know, and recovery is really saving one's ass, not necessarily saving one's soul. There's two different things to look at there if you are someone of religion. However, I highly recommend getting your ass saved. You know what I'm saying? That's kind of important. Then over on page 29 it says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we have recovered with an ED. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. So, the book is going to lay out how these early members recovered. And the great thing about this is, and you know, it took me a long time to really get into this stuff, because when I first was exposed to it, like a lot of people, I saw it as a 1939 book written by some stockbroker loser, and you know, it wasn't well written, and they're trying to fool you about this God thing, and you know, they're asking you to do all this crazy stuff, and none of it really flows very well. And you know, I like the step book, and I like to go to meetings, you know, and that really was my approach. Well, after suffering in Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many months, I was exposed to this recovery process, and it saved my life. The difference between sobriety and recovery is like the difference between night and day. It's like the difference between black and white. It's the difference between life and death for many of us. Sobriety, although it's a really good idea, if it's not followed up by a recovery program, if you really suffer from addictive illness, you're not going to be able to escape that addictive illness. This recovery process makes you comfortable moving through your life without help from sedatives or alcohol or whatever happens to be your drug of choice. I think we're special. I think, you know, I've done a lot of studies on ancient religions and spiritual traditions, and there's a mystical tradition in the three monotheistic religions. That's Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. There are people that they call mystics. And these mystics are people who go very, very deep into the tradition. There are people like Thomas Merton, and you know, there's a whole bunch of them. And what they'll do is they'll go on silent retreats for months and months and months. I mean, they go deep into this stuff. They pray, and they, you know, and they do these devotions, and it is insane how much intensity they put into this because they want to seek a direct connection with God, and they're giving it everything they have. Those are the mystics. They want more out of a spiritual experience than a normal person who's just, you know, going to church on Sunday. I think we are mystics. I think the people that go after the booze and the drugs, we're mystics. We are seeking a connection with God when we do that. We are not comfortable unless we are using. We constantly think about, you know, if I only had a little bit of this, or if I only had a little bit of that, that would bring me to a place where I feel one, you know? And I truly think that alcoholics and addicts are misplaced mystics. What we need to do is we need to channel that intensity going after those substances and the alcohol. We need to channel that into going after a direct connection with God. Because that is what is going to finally make us feel okay. We've been looking to feel okay for a long time. And the final destination is recovery and a connection with God. As you understand God, you know, AA is very, very specific about that. They are not about to start telling you how you need to worship, how you know what attributes your God has to have, you know, where you have to what religions you should be in. The 12-step programs are not about that. They're not about telling you what kind of a God you need to have. They're about telling you if you don't get a relationship with God, you're going to die. That's what they tell you. I'm going to jump over to more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, Chris will control and enjoy his drinking is his great obsession. You know, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. That is our obsession. Why in the world would you pick up booze after going to AA meetings for 2 or 4 years or whatever? Why would you relapse? Why would you do that? The great obsession is that, you know, this time it's going to work for me. You know, this time it'll be okay. If we even think about it at all, you know, we're thinking that we're going to be able to figure out how to control this. And it's because sobriety is untenable to us. You know, we're not happy unless we have a spiritual conversion experience. We're not going to be happy in our own skin just being sober. It's just not going to be good enough for us. We learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. So the steps are up on the wall. You know how you have the long form and the short form of the traditions? Well, the short form of the steps is up on the wall. To figure out what they really mean, you've got to go into the book. So admitting you're an alcoholic, that's not really step one. Step one is fully conceding to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic. And they've explained and are explaining what an alcoholic is. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Anybody ever felt pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization? You ever come to, like, you know, like Monday morning with the DUI summons in your back pocket or something, or you know? You're out in the doghouse, I used to do the craziest things. I was constantly pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. I was an electrician during the 80s. I don't know how that happened. One day I woke up, you know, and I was an electrician, and it was a really, really bad trade to be in. You know, when you shook every morning, you know, 'cause I was constantly blowing things up, and I was constantly sick. Now this once I was working with this guy who really thought I was lame. You know, he was in the truck. We were buddies, and the boss would send us out together, and we'd go wire something. You know, I was always, you know, electrocuting him by mistake or something. So he was not real happy with me. And this one time, you know how you're really thirsty in the morning if you've drank like a quart of whiskey and you have to rehydrate?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I bought a half a gallon of grape drink this morning, this one morning, and I drank it down, and then I went to work. And, you know, we're on the side of this house. We're putting a new service on. So that's the electrical meter and the panel. And I'm messing around in the truck, and all of a sudden my stomach starts going like this, and I go, uh-oh, I've got 6.4 seconds to get somewhere because I'm gonna lose this lunch. Now, I didn't want him to see me vomiting because it would have made me look small. So what I did was I tore around the back of this house that we were working on, and I just get around the back of the house, and I... Whoa! I mean, it was like opening up a fire hydrant. I stuccoed the back of this house with purple vomit. I mean, just stuccoed this house. And I thought I was alone, you know. But what had happened was I looked over, and not 15 feet away is the back deck on the adjoining property with a family sitting there having a nice day. It's like a mother, a father, and three kids sitting there having a nice day. And every one of them had the same look on their face. It was like, you know, "Mommy, Mommy, the purple puke monster from hell, Mommy!" Oh God! I was forever blowing things up and wiring things wrong, and my boss was. I mean, this would go on and on and on. And then this one time I even called up in a drunken blackout and threatened my boss's life. I was going to kill him. I'm going to kill you. And didn't remember it because it was in a blackout and went into work the next day, you know? I mean, talk about, like, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And then there were times when I just couldn't go to work, and I had to just call my boss up and say, I'm shattered. I'm shattered. I'm losing my mind. You know, I can't come in. And, you know, being this way, being, you know, deteriorating like this, then I would start to get really violent, and the last drunk I was on, I ended up threatening my family with a handgun. The last time I was drunk. Now, when you come out of something like that and you realize what you've done, you know, that's pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I have never met an alcoholic who's evil. I haven't. I've met people that are evil in AA. I mean, they'll slide their butts in here, you know, for one reason or another to prey on the weak and helpless. You know, be predators. I've met evil in these rooms, but I've never met an alcoholic who is evil. We're not evil people. You know, we do bad things. We're not really bad people. We suffer incredibly from the bad things that we do because we have a conscience, you know, And we get to a point where we suffer. Mother Teresa was asked one time, "What's the saddest thing you ever seen?" And remember, she's feeding the starving children in Bangladesh and stuff. She goes, "The saddest thing I've ever seen is the loneliness of an alcoholic." Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, think about that. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period of time, we get worse, never better. If somebody comes up to you, in an AA meeting, if you're new, and they shake your hand, they say, "Keep coming, it gets better." Understand, they're lying to you. Okay, it doesn't get better. Your alcoholism is always going to get worse, but you can put it in remission. Now, here's what I mean by that: the liver and the pancreas of an alcoholic metabolize alcohol differently than Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd. Okay, they can have two or three glasses of wine and they don't get the craving. They don't go into the city to get cocaine. You know what I mean? They're fine with like a couple of glasses of wine. Now, what happens with us is it's a completely different experience. We get the phenomenon of craving and we're off to the races, and we have very little control over that. Now, the liver and the pancreas are really the cause of that. What happens is it breaks down alcohol differently and it throws this stuff back into the bloodstream that creates an actual craving, a physiological craving. And the more alcohol you have, the more the craving. And this is never going to get better. So I knew a guy. He was doing a lot of talks all over the country, and man, this guy was on the money. Even to this day, I love listening to him. But he got to the point where he was 20 years sober, and he read some statistics that every 7 years or so, or every 14 years, every single cell in your body regenerates. So you're an entirely new person every 14 years, because every cell dies off and every cell is reborn. So he came to the conclusion that he can't possibly be alcoholic anymore, because he's a completely different person. Every cell in his body is different. And he went off and he tried some controlled drinking, which he's not come back from yet. You know? If you cross the line to the point where you experience the phenomenon of craving with alcohol, you've crossed the line. You can never drink alcohol safely again, ever. 50 years from now, you can't drink alcohol again safely. You need to stay abstinent. And understand, the problem is staying abstinent. You can't do it, is what this book is saying. If you could do it, you know, they'd hand out a pamphlet at every detox saying, "Don't drink," and you'd be fine. But you know that's not what happens with us. We figure out every kind of way we possibly can to figure out how to start drinking again. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in this class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. So I'll tell you what, you know, I'm going to go over a couple of tests here. This book actually has tests for whether or not you have the allergy of the body and whether or not you have the obsession of the mind. So if you're unclear on step one, this book is going to have some directions for you. Not the type of directions that you're going to hear shared, you know, in the next discussion meeting, most likely. But it's got some directions in here, because it's important to be able to get to your truth in step one. We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide if you are honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of the jitters if you get full knowledge of your condition. Now understand, I am not telling anybody in here to go over to the bar and try some controlled drinking. It's in this book, and it's in the book because they believe that without an accurate understanding of step one, there's going to be little motivation for you to go through the rest of the recovery process. Only if you know you are painted into a corner will you move forward with this stuff. Marty Mann was the first woman to stay sober in AA, and she started the National Council on Alcoholism and got very, very involved with alcohol and drug policy and stuff. She did an enormous amount of good for us, and her good works are still carrying on today. But one of the things was the Marty Mann test, and the Marty Mann test was this: take 2 ounces of alcohol, okay, every single day for 6 months. Now that would be like two tumblers of bourbon or 2 tumblers of whiskey or two beers or 2 big glasses of wine every single day for 6 months. You know, exactly 2. You can't save them up, you know. Just 2. Now, what will happen is, if you're alcoholic, 9 times out of 10, what will happen is, you'll think to yourself, this is kind of a stupid test, you know? I made it 2 days already. You know, what's with the 6 months? You know, I've proved I'm not an alcoholic, so I think I'll celebrate that, you know? And, I mean, you know, all of a sudden you'll be drinking like a fish. And you'll outsmart the test. So if there's any reason why you don't do it exactly the way it's explained, you know, you've blown the test and you're probably alcoholic. Now rarely will I use this on somebody. Only if someone is so clueless about their own drinking. A lot of times somebody will be shot to me because, you know, they had a DUI or their parents caught them toking a joint or something, you know, and they'll end up, and, you know, we just don't know if they're an alcoholic or they're powerless over drugs at that point in time. And, you know, sometimes I'll point them to this, but rarely. Most of the time you can find, from digging into someone's experience, you can come up with example after example after example of the decisions they made that they didn't follow through with where it concerns alcohol. All right, how many times did you stop off from work? You're just going to have 2 with the boys. You know you need to be home for dinner with the wife. You stop and you're going to have 2 for the boy, and you close the place down and you wake up and weehawking with 1 shoe. All right? And you think, oh, I just kind of changed my mind and I decided to blow my whole paycheck, close the bar down, wake up and weehawking with 1 shoe. No, you weren't even there for that decision. What happened was you started drinking and you lost all control. You didn't have any control. You know, weehawking, here you came, and you you were being driven by that physiological craving for more alcohol. Now they talk about a man of 30. This is the example they use for people who think that because they've been sober 20 years, they can start drinking again. It's a great example of why you can't do that. I explained the reason your liver and your pancreas are never going to heal to the point where you will not experience that physical craving. And there's been no drugs that I'm aware of that'll stop that craving either. Over on page 34, as we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, this is the test for the obsession of the mind. If you think you can keep you sober and you don't really need this AA, you don't need this 12 steps, I don't need a sponsor telling me what to do, you know, I'm not going to make coffee for anybody, I don't drink coffee. You know, if you have that type of belligerent attitude and you think you got this, I got this. I read the pamphlets, okay? I got this. You know, is AA for you? I got it, you know. Here's the test. Let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. Right, just stop drinking. Don't go to meetings. Don't call your sponsor. Don't read, you know, alcoholism books. Just quit drinking. Okay, if you got a drinking problem, stop drinking. Problem over, okay? Stop drinking. Now, very few alcoholics are going to make it a year, because what will happen again? You'll say to yourself, man, you know, a year? I've already made it a week and a half. That proves, what's the additional 11 and a half months going to prove? I got this. I'm going to the bar. That's what will happen if you're alcoholic. You'll mysteriously change your mind. And your ego will want to take ownership of that, like you really had any say at all, being powerless. So that's the test. That's the test on whether you have the obsession of the mind. Now, there's many people here tonight who, if they thought about having two beers every single day for 6 months, no more, no less, you can't save them up. That would horrify them. Because I never wanted two beers. You want a beer? Not if all you have is two beers. I don't. Are you crazy? Now, if you got two cases, you know, we can talk. Now, you know, so these are the tests. These are the tests to see if we're an alcoholic. If we can't use our own experience, 99 out of 100 of us can use our own experience. You know, how many times did I say I was not going to drink anymore? I'm never going to drink again, ever. I mean it, you know. And I will celebrate that decision to not drink with a bottle of whiskey. You know? If he's a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there's scant chance of success. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period of time, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. Now, here's where it starts to talk about, you know, what we need to start looking at. It says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We're assuming, of course, the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. All right, this is one of the most important sentences in this book. Whether such a person can quit, you know, any type of addiction, any type of obsessive compulsive disorder, you can plug into this. If you're a drug addict, if you're an alcoholic, if you have a process addiction like gambling or sex or food, okay, you can plug this in here. It says, whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Over on page 35, what sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree have brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into his saloon. Why does he? What is he thinking? Then they give the example of Jim. Jim is a really, really great example. Down at the bottom, he's agreed. He's met up with the AA boys, you know, and he sees them as like an overreaction to a problem that he really has some control over, okay? He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for which he had a deep affection, yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. And it goes down here. Now, when they use the squiggly font in this book, I have to assume that they really want us to pay attention to it. This is him explaining taking that first drink. Because that's the insanity. We are insane to take that first drink. So here's what he says. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. He'd been to the asylum, okay? He was going to lose his family. He was going to lose his job, his home, everything. He had every reason in the world not to drink. He knew what the consequences were going to be. But suddenly the thought crossed his mind that he could put some whiskey in some milk. Okay? I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. Now, here's the thing. This is a beautiful snapshot of powerlessness. All right? If suddenly hits you, do you got time to call your sponsor? Do you got time to pick up a coffee commitment down at the club? No. If suddenly hits you, you're drinking milk and whiskey. You know what I mean? And that's it. You don't even think about it. You vaguely sense this might not be such a good idea. And all of a sudden you're banging on the bar going, how the hell could I have got drunk again? This is nuts. This is a beautiful example of powerlessness. This happened to me. I signed myself into a 28-day treatment. I went off to Happy Hills. Okay, I got out of the 28-day treatment and I joined up with the outpatient process. I was going to AA meetings two a week and I was going to two outpatient a week. And I was telling everybody, I'm done drinking forever. This is it. You know, I'm going in for the cure. I'm done. As I'm going to an AA meeting, the thought crosses my mind that it's been almost 3 months since I've been drunk. I don't even remember what it's like to be drunk. I don't see how I can possibly do this stuff without really understanding what the heck is going on. I'll bet you if I bought a gallon of vodka and I drank it, it would make me feel so bad I would zoom back in to that AA and outpatient and everything, and I'd really do a bang-up job on it. And so I went and I bought a gallon of vodka and I started drinking it, and one drink, good idea. Sounds like a good idea. Two drinks. Yeah, it's a good idea. Good idea. Starting to feel it. Third drink. Oh my God, what have I done? I've opened up the cage door to the beast, and I'm going to be dragged around like a rag doll. Now think about this. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that buying a gallon of vodka would improve my sobriety. Okay? That's what happened to me. And three drinks into this vodka, I realized I'd made a horrible mistake. Because I opened it up. I'm back in now. And I'm physically back addicted, physically back with the craving. And it was 7 months before I could get sober again. So I understand this stuff. I know what powerlessness looks like. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. It's my favorite line in the book. I have a t-shirt that says that. I do. Here was a threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of the intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, okay? He'd been with the AAs. Yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he had mixed it with milk. All right? Well, kid, all you really need to do is keep your memory green. I don't think so. I think suddenly you'll go right over that green. It'll go right through that green light. You know what I mean? Whatever the precise definition of the word wave may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? And then they say, you may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched. For this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. Every single one of us has approached alcohol in an insane state of mind. Like, this will be great. I'm on the way to DUI court. You know, I'll stop off at the bar on the way to DUI court. I mean, I did that. You know. Well, we've sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day we'd ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity, how could it have happened? Now, there's a lot of brain chemistry work that's being done, brain science work that's being done that's explaining this. This is beautiful. This is a near clinical in its explanation of the obsession of the mind. And the science that they're doing on alcoholics and drug addicts at this point in time is lining right up with this. Okay, it's real proofs for this theorem that those guys wrote back in 1939. Then they talk about the Jaywalker. One of my favorite treatment centers is the Jaywalker Lodge. It's out west. The Jaywalker is the guy who really enjoys jumping, you know, running in front of cars and just missing, you know, just getting missed. And he gets a real thrill out of it, but he starts to get hit. He starts to get run over and his legs start to get broken. Everybody's saying, look, man, you're nuts. You got to stop jumping in front of cars. No. You know, I'll be careful. You know, and then he finally gets his back broken, okay? And everybody's like looking at this guy like, what an idiot. What an idiot. How does he not know how dangerous it is? How does he not know how much trouble he's in? When I first read this, I thought, this has nothing to do with me. Every single night, I got drunk out of my mind, and I would land on the floor, and I don't know about anybody else, but I would wake up with contusions, and, you know, you ever wake up with, like, injuries that you have absolutely no idea how you got, you know, like, stitches, and I'm the Jaywalker, and it's getting worse. You know, a trolley car's on the way, you know? That's me. Now they talk about Fred. They talk about Fred's a partner, he was interested when they talked to him. He was interested and concluded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. How many newcomers have you gone up to who've got this kind of an attitude? Yeah, I've got some of these symptoms, but, you know, I really got this. You know, well, you know, I'd like you to come over to my house, and, you know, every Tuesday to start going through the steps. There's three home group meetings I want you to be at. You know, here's my phone number. I want to call at least a couple of times a week to see what's going on with you. I'd like you to take on a coffee commitment as soon as you can. And it's like, oh wow, man. You know, like I'd hook up with all that, but the Grateful Dead are touring, and I always take the summer off to tour with the Dead. And you know, they're a long way from admitting that they can do nothing about it themselves. They don't get it. Fred's example, Fred's explanation of drinking again is this. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all. Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and my meal. This is another guy that's been in the asylum. He's just going to have a little cocktail. You know, a little drinky poo. And then back to the asylum, you know. This really is. And not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I'm going to read the last paragraph in the chapter more about alcoholism. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. And that's absolutely true. Mental defense against the first drink is problematic. Now, I want to close tonight with one of my favorite stories. This story comes from a friend of mine who's no longer with us, Scott Redmond from Sherman Oaks, California, and this is my favorite story that he told. This happened to somebody in his home group. Newcomer, you know, he's new about like 3 months or something, and he's just kind of like moping around, and his sponsor goes up to him and says, you know, what's the matter with you? And he goes, I'm bored. And his sponsor goes, you know why you're bored? And he goes, no. And the sponsor goes, because you're boring. And, you know, he goes like, whoa, like, wow. You know, what a great answer. And he thought to himself, I can't wait to use that on somebody. You know? Now, 8 years it takes. 8 years it takes for this to happen. But he's standing at the coffee pot, and a newcomer, good-looking newcomer woman, comes up, and she's pouring coffee. And she lets out a big sigh, like, and he's thinking, all right. He goes, anything wrong? And she goes, yeah, I'm bored. And the light bulb goes up, and he goes, you know why you're bored? And she looks at him, and she goes, yeah, because I'm with you. Thanks a lot.